On June 15, 2010, the Island Institute's Community Wind Group gave a presentation on a proposed wind farm for Ragged Mountain in Camden, Maine. The presentation was made to the Camden Select Board, as well as interested members of the public, and was also televised. The presentation was given by George Baker of the Island Institute's Community Wind Group. This first section is 30 minutes long.
Thanks, everyone, for attending the Camden Select Board's meeting on June 15, 2010. All right, I'm going to make a little change in the agenda tonight. Item 3, Maine Coast Community Wind Presentation by George Baker. We're moving that up to item 2. All right? So we'll be taking that next. Is Mr. Baker here?
I work at the Island Institute, Suzanne and I, Phillip's here, as part of the Maine Coast Community Wind Group. And we began discussions with the Camden Energy Committee some time ago, just very preliminarily looking at the feasibility, the possibility of energy projects, renewable energy projects, in particular a possible wind power project on Ragged Mountain. And so, let's see, let's go ahead. My agenda, a brief introduction, talk a little bit about the project on climate haven, talk about the goals for this study that the Energy Committee asked us to do, talk a little bit about electricity markets and Camden's potential role, and then look at the organizational options. This looks like a lot of things, but the whole thing will take 20 minutes, so it's not as bad as it looks. So the Maine Coast Community Wind Group is a group out of the Island Institute. We offer technical, financial, environmental services to communities seeking to develop locally owned wind power projects. And we're very much about community ownership, community involvement in the process. We've been providing support for the Fox Islands, Vinyl Haven and North Haven, for Monhegan, and for Swan's Island, including a couple of other mainland communities, including Camden. The way that we have approached these projects in the past is in a three-phase project with lots of opportunities for stopping, checking, seeing how things are going. What we have typically done is an initial feasibility study, spending somewhere between $50,000 and $70,000, that involves three chunks of feasibility: a logistical technical feasibility analysis, an economic and financial feasibility analysis, and an environmental feasibility analysis. We do this without spending too much money. As you can see, you know, doing that for $50,000 or $70,000 isn't that much. And the purpose of that is to provide enough information to a community so that they can take a well-informed vote as to whether they want to then go on and start spending real money to find out whether this is something that can be done. So that initial feasibility work is really, it's not going to permitting, it's not putting together financing, it's gathering enough information that a community can make a well-informed decision about whether they want to go forward with this. And so that's the first phase. If, and then generally at the end of that time, a community takes a vote. And exactly who votes and exactly how that works is something that has to get worked out with the community who's in. The definition of the community is very clear when you're on an island. It's less clear when you're on the mainland. So you've got to sort of figure out who the relevant community is, and you have to craft a voting mechanism that will allow the community to really have voice as to whether they want to do this thing or not. If the community decides that it wants to go forward with a project, you then have to do the hard work. That's when you have to start hiring lawyers, engineers, you know, financial people to figure out whether you can really do one of these things. That can cost anywhere from $300,000 to $500,000. Those are all costs that will get rolled into the cost of the project, assuming that it goes forward. But that's a risky part of the project, to be sure, because you have to spend real money before you know that you're going to get a permit, before you know that you're going to be able to finance it. Once again, there are a set of sort of gate points along the way through there. You could discover partway into that there are you know, problems with financing that make the project not possible. There are problems with permitting that make the project not possible. So there's lots of ways in the places in the pre-development process where you may discover that the project either is not feasible or not possible. If you get through that, then you actually go and start. It's not mine. Nothing I'm doing?
No.
And then once you get through that, you go into construction, and now you're spending real money, and how much that costs, of course, depends almost entirely on the size of the project and what's involved. Okay, so prior to phase one, the Canton Energy Committee, in a series of discussions early on, and this must have been back in October, I guess, asked the question: in our case, who would even be doing this? Like, what organization would pay for the feasibility study? Who would benefit from a project like this? What's the organizational entity that would engage in this project? And so what the Energy Committee asked us to do was go away and study this question in the context of community ownership as we had developed it on the Fox Islands. And so the question was, can you, on the mainland, where you don't have your own electric company, out on Vinalhaven, there's a consumer-owned cooperative that owns all the lines and wires and the electric company. Can you have a community-owned project with community benefit in the context of a community like Canton? So that was the question that we were asked to study. That's the question that we're going to answer today, or make a recommendation about today, as to sort of how that might work in a community like Canton. So, quickly review the Fox Island project out of Vinalhaven. back in 2008, the community voted 384-5 to go forward with this project. The local electric cooperative owns and operates the project, buys and sells electricity over an 11-mile submarine cable. The financing was done with tax equity investment from a local company that wanted to support the project. And financed also with a large federally guaranteed loan from the Rural Utility Service. And 100% of the benefits of that project come back to the community in the form of lower electric rates. So there's no outside developer. There's nobody making profits from this project. All of the benefit from that flows back directly to the members of the Fox Island Electric Co-op in the form of electric rates that are 4 or 5 cents per kilowatt hour lower than they were before this project got started. And so that's part of the reason, a big part of the reason, that the community feels the kind of ownership and pride that they feel about that project. And even with the current issues with Sound that you may have heard about, there was just a survey done of members of the cooperative last month, and the community is still 98% in favor of this project, overwhelmingly supportive of the project out there on Vinalhaven, in large part because it's their control, it's their project, they use the electricity, they get the benefit. So the question was, can we think about a way of doing a project in tandem to develop ownership options that replicate a kind of community support and financeability of the Fox Island Wind Project through community ownership, community economic benefit through rate reduction, community use of the electricity, and still be able to do that while accessing the various different types of subsidies that are available for these types of projects. You can't do these projects if you can't take advantage of the various subsidy programs that are out there offered by the federal tax code and the Rural Utility Service. So the question was, can you combine community ownership with accessing the federal subsidies in the context of a community project on the mainland where you're also getting customers? Right? And that's the big problem, right, is that you can't exactly own your local electric company. You don't want to. CMP owns it, and you want to leave it that way. So can you replicate the situation on the Fox Islands? And so that was the question, and that's what we set out to try and answer. In order to explain or help you to understand part of the problem, I need to give you a very short... So I should explain a little bit. So I'm a professor. I'm a teacher. Right? So I'm going to give you a very short lecture now on electricity markets. I apologize. So very brief lecture on post-deregulation electricity markets. So in the olden days, your electric company, CMP, used to generate electricity and deliver it to you over wires that they owned. They owned transmission, they owned distribution, they owned generation. They were vertically integrated. Around 15 years ago, we decided to deregulate electricity, not in all states, but certainly in all states in New England and most states in this region. And as a result, Central Maine Power, Bangor Hydro, Maine Public Service, no longer own any generation facilities. Bangor Hydro does not own a single hydro facility. They sold them all, the Florida Power Company. And so we've separated generation from transmission and distribution in this country. So CFE owns wires, they own transformers, they own substations, but they don't generate electricity. They deliver electricity to you. CFE is the FedEx of the electricity business. Right? They don't own the stuff that they deliver any more than FedEx owns the stuff that they deliver. They merely deliver it to you. Okay? And where you buy your electricity as a residential consumer over from something called the standard offer. It's a package put together by CMP and the Public Utilities Commission, and you buy it through CMP's wires. By the way, you can buy electricity from anybody you want. You don't have to buy over the standard offer. Right? You could go to some other seller of electricity and buy it from them. And some people do. You can go on the web, actually, and you can find out about, you know, green energy from such and such a place. And you can do that. Okay? So this is going to be an opportunity. This is going to be one of the ways that we're going to try and figure out how to get local benefit to the community from electricity generated from a local wind project. And so there are these companies out there called competitive energy providers, or sometimes competitive energy suppliers, CEPs or CESs. Constellation, NextEra, there's a whole bunch of them, that serve as intermediaries in the power market between generators and end users. Usually big industrial end users, but potentially residential consumers as well. Okay? So what we're going to try and do is figure out how in this structure to have a community-owned wind project that delivers electricity to local consumers. All right, let's go. So if there were to be a project on Ragged Mountain, the question is, who would own the turbines legally and operationally? Right? So in other words, there's going to have to be a generator, some entity company that's going to own these things, and it's going to be a generator in the story that I just told about, a deregulated generator of electricity. The PPA stands for Power Purchase Agreement. Who would buy the output of that, let's say, community-owned generation facility? What entity is going to buy the output? Wind is intermittent. Your television is not, right? Who's going to make sure that if you are buying your electricity from an intermittent wind project, that you still have electricity to run your television whenever you want to? Right? So there's going to have some entity in there that's going to buy the extra when you're generating more than you're using and provide the electricity when the wind isn't blowing. Okay, so there's going to be some entity in there who's going to have to keep supply and demand balanced. And once you've done all that, is this structure financeable? Because whoever's going to be on the other side of that power purchase agreement, let's say the community is going to own this generation facility, it has to be able to sell that energy to some company that is big enough and hefty enough that when you try and go and borrow money to finance your wind farm, that you can say, I've got a power purchase agreement with a real party on the other side. Okay? And so these are all the questions that we were looking at to try and understand whether there's a structure that might work. By the way, nobody's ever done this before. Right? I mean, that's the real. If this had been done before, then we would just go look up how somebody else did it. But nobody's ever tried to do this before. So there's a bunch of research. And do we have a slide on methodology? I don't think we do. So the way that, you know, we went and we got a bunch of lawyers and a bunch of regulators, and we sat down in rooms in, you know, various conference rooms, and we just started hashing things out and throwing around ideas and trying to understand some of the things that I just explained to you to try and see whether there is any way within the current regulatory and legal structure to put something like this together. And what we're going to see is the result of that. Okay. So one question, sort of a very early question to ask is, in all of this, what's Camden's role? What's the town of Camden's role in something like this? And we're not answering that question here, right? I mean, Camden's role could be anything from a landlord, nothing more than a landlord, because Camden owns much of the land up there, not all of it, but much of it, to an owner of the turbines. And that the town itself could take any number of roles between those two extremes, which is that it's a town-owned project, maybe that's what we mean by community-owned, right? Two, the town is nothing but a landlord and there's some, you know, new entity set up that would do this that would be owned somehow by the community or something. So that's not a question that we're answering, although there's a bunch of possibilities there. The potential benefits too candid, vary, but it could include, you know, if you're a landlord, then of course it would be lease payments or tax revenues, lower and more stable electricity bills for residents, reduced greenhouse gas emissions because you would be buying less electricity from fossil fuel power plants, and the ability to support the state's renewable energy goals. I mean, the state's goal of 3 gigawatts of onshore wind by 2020, and there's a lot of work to be done if the state is going to meet those goals. There's another huge question, which is the role of the other towns around. What role, if any, do Rockport, Lincolnville, Hope, Appleton, and any number of other communities around who have an interest, you know, a positive interest, a negative interest, whatever kind of interest they might have in this? And so you'll see there are question marks all over this slide, right, because we don't have the answers to most of these questions, but there are a range of possibilities for exactly what role Camden might play in this. Okay. So we looked, after doing some preliminary work, we looked at 4 possible options for this ownership model. And that is something that we're going to call a contract with a competitive energy producer. That's going to be our favorite option. That's going to be the one that we're going to end up recommending as the way to go. Although we also looked at possibly doing this through something called the Community Wind Act, setting up a community supply group, and then a sort of 4th option, which is different, quite a bit smaller, but sort of what we're calling Plan B, which is net metering. I'm going to talk about each of them. I'm going to spend most of my time talking about option 1, which is the competitive energy provider, because we think it's the best option. Okay, so the way this option would work is the following. You would bring in an existing, well-established competitive energy provider. Let's call it Constellation Energy, just to have a label to put on it. Who would go to citizens of whatever community you chose to be part of this and say, we will sell you your electricity. We will be your electricity provider delivered over CMP's wires for the next 5 years, 10 years, however long you could get that contract. Okay, so that's the first piece that you need to do. You would need to create a for-profit, community-owned entity, which we might call Ragged Mountain Wind LLC, that would build and operate the wind project. That would build and operate the wind project. It needs to be for-profit because it needs to be able to take advantage of federal tax subsidies. It doesn't actually have to make any profits, but legally speaking, it has to be a for-profit entity. That's exactly what Fox Island Wind is at our bottom table. Fox Island Wind is, legally speaking, a for-profit company that makes no profits. 100% it makes zero profits, all the benefits flow through to the residents. But from the IRS's perspective, it's a for-profit company so that it's able to take advantage of the federal tax and credits that go along with that. Okay? You would bring in a tax equity investor who would be a large percentage but passive owner of that for-profit that is your generation company, okay? And that's where you would be able to take advantage of these tax benefits. And then what would happen was this competitive energy supplier, we'll call it Constellation, would buy the power from Ragged Mountain Wind LLC under a standard power purchase agreement. So Constellation would say, we will buy 100% of the output of Ragged Mountain Wind LLC. We will buy it for X number of dollars per kilowatt hour. Constellation is a big company. That's a good, solid power purchase agreement. Ragged Mountain Wind LLC can go out and finance the project on the strength of the power purchase agreement that it's gotten with Constellation. And Constellation would then turn around and sell that energy to the citizens of whatever community you set up as being part of this. And to the extent that the wind power project is able to generate electricity at a cost lower than what you could buy it for elsewhere, those citizens, those members of the community, would get electricity for cheaper than what it would cost them to get it if they were buying it over the standard offer or off the market. Okay? And so you have this slightly complicated structure in which you've got the community-owned entity doing the generating, selling the variable output to Constellation, Constellation filling in the gaps and selling electricity back to the community, but the price that the community gets would depend on how much it costs for the wind company to generate that electricity. And from what very preliminary work has been done so far, it looks like the wind resource on Ragged Mountain is quite spectacular. And so the cost of generating electricity could actually be quite low, depending on all kinds of things that, you know, haven't been answered yet about the feasibility of the project. Okay, so this is not perfectly straightforward, and there are some challenges associated with trying to put together a structure like this. And we have some preliminary answers to some of these challenges, but not all of them. So the first question that we asked was, will such a structure attract the interest of any competitive energy providers? Or is this just too complicated and too messy and too small for anybody to be really interested in? We've had a couple of conversations with a couple of potential CPPs, and indeed, they are interested. At this size, you know, on the order of, they said, we don't like to go less than 1 megawatt. Well, there's no chance that we would build anything smaller than 1 megawatt, probably. That might not be true, but at the rate, to generate enough electricity that would really have an impact in the community, it needs to be bigger than that. And they were definitely interested. They're not interested in having to do the retail sales part. They're not interested in going out and having to find the retail customers. So part of the project would be bringing the community together, deciding who wants to be part of this thing, and sort of delivering a package to that CEP that says, here are the 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 residents of this community interested in being part of this. So that would be part of the process of putting together. It would be not just putting together a wind project, but it would also be putting together a community that wants to buy electricity from it. That would be something that you would have to do as part of organizing the project. But they were definitely interested in the possibility. Okay? There's a certain amount of contractual complexity. This is not a straightforward transaction. It would be complicated. Everybody would have to understand. You'd have to work it through with the, you know, with the constellations of the world. You'd need to work it through with the community. You'd need to make sure everybody understands. You really would be, though, in a sense, the community would be using the electricity from this project. I mean, we can have philosophical debates about where the electrons go, and, you know, I don't really care where the electrons go, right? The point is, this thing is generating electricity, it's being bought by a company and sold to the residents, right? And the wires are all running around. So there's a real argument that says that the community would be using the electricity generated by the new project and benefiting from the low cost that would come from generating that. And then finally, there's a question about whether a CEP can be signed up. You need to sign up the competitive energy provider early enough on that you can begin to have financing discussions with real lenders, right? So there's a kind of sequencing issue in putting together the deal. But once again, the preliminary discussions that we had with the competitive energy supplier suggested that they would be willing to not make commitments, but get far enough down the road that you could then begin to have discussions with financiers so that you could, you know, sort of cobble the package together in the pre-development process. Okay, we're getting close to the end. So that's the option that we think is actually the most promising and the one that's most likely to achieve the goals of community ownership, community use of the electricity, and community benefit through lower electric prices. We did look at some others. There's a new piece of legislation passed last year called the Community Wind Act, LB 1075, which enables community-owned generators to sell power to the Public Utilities Commission for a fixed price of up to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Once again, it's brand new. Nobody's done it before. The rules are still extremely up in the air. I've had several conversations with Mitch Tannenbaum at the PUC asking specific questions. He goes, George, we just don't know yet. You know, the rules have not been crafted yet to really understand. There are a bunch of concerns. The program is not very big, so it's limited to 10. Any one project is limited to 10 megawatts. That's probably bigger than what's likely to happen up there. There's just not enough room for something that size. One of the problems is that you would be selling 100% of the energy off to the grid, off to the PUC. So sort of arguing or claiming that the community is using the electricity generated by the project is kind of a stretch, since you're explicitly selling it off to the whole rest of the state. And similarly, it would be hard to bring those benefits back to the community. I mean, you'd need to bring them back in some indirect way that isn't going to involve lowering electric. Okay, and so that's not the only way to deliver benefits, but we think that's one of the ways that makes, you know, the community acceptance of these things be stronger. So we didn't think that worked as well. Another possibility that a couple people suggested was that Before even starting this project, Camden and possibly neighboring communities set up something called a community supply group. This would be a company that would be set up to buy electricity for the community. And you'd sign up as many people as you can and you'd get them into this community supply group. And then once that thing is up and operating and has a track record, that thing could be the entity that signs the PPA with the generation company. Right? And so you could do that, but that's got some really tricky sequencing problems. Because if you have to set up the CSG ahead of time, which is expensive. There's a lot of startup costs associated with that. And if the wind project never happened, then you have this CSG that may or may not be a really great idea in the absence of the wind project. You know, so there's a lot of sort of problems when you really started thinking about the steps that you'd have to take and the order that you'd have to do things in. It looked like a risky proposition for the community, and probably not something that we thought was going to work quite as well. We then looked at what we sort of called Plan B, and Plan B is smaller, quite a bit smaller, but it would involve something called net metering. So what net metering means is that you set up a renewable energy facility. It can be wind, it can be solar, it can be tidal, it can be anything. And you build it, sort of think about, here is us, right? We have a meter right here, right? And we buy electricity over this meter. If we put a generating facility on this side, right, when we're buying electricity, the meter runs this way. When we're generating electricity, the meter runs that way. And at the end of any moment in time, we don't pay for how much electricity we used. We pay for how much we used minus how much we generated. Literally, you let the meter run backwards. Okay? And that actually turns out to be very advantageous. You can only do it up to 660 kilowatts. You can't. The law doesn't allow you to do it for any more than that. But you could have a shared turbine owned by the community. And you could sign up a bunch of entities, town-owned entities, schools, town buildings, libraries, and have them be what are inside here, right? And so you'd sign up a bunch of town buildings, you'd put a 660 kilowatt turbine sort of conceptually inside this box, and you would net meter that electricity, right? And this would work, actually. And you probably could make the economics work. I think I want to go to the next slide. Yeah, can we go to the next slide? The disadvantages are that putting up one 660 kilowatt turbine is really a small project. And there are real diseconomies of scale. So it would be electricity would be much more expensive per kilowatt hour than a bigger project. And the total economic benefit to the community is limited because residents don't benefit. You can't sign. You're only allowed to, I think, put, is it 10 different entities within this box? So you wouldn't be able to sign up individual residents. So individuals wouldn't get the benefit of lower electricity prices, except insofar as the town benefited, taxes went down, everybody benefits from that, right? But so the direct benefit to residents would be less. It's unclear whether a tax equity investor would be as interested in investing in something like that. However, it is a sort of smaller step, an easier way to get into something like this. Okay, so I just have one more slide, which basically summarizes all of this, and we don't need to go through that, except to see that as you sort of look at the community use, community benefit, community ownership, utilizing the subsidies, and then what the challenges are of each of these things. Our assessment is pretty strongly that option one, the competitive energy provider, was the best option to go with. That would be our recommendation for how to think about this if you do decide to go forward with a feasibility study for the project. And that's all I have to talk about. I'm happy to take questions. I don't know if you want to take over the floor at this point or how you want to go from there.
Okay, does anybody have any questions regarding this?
For more information about this and other Penobscot Bay-related issues, go to the Penobscot Bay blog, penobscotbay.blogspot.com.